Okay, so we'll get started in just a minute, and probably a few people coming late. Not everybody in Buddhism gets their timing as precise as do Oprah Winfrey and Deepak Chopra. Now, has anybody heard of the Oprah Winfrey Deepak Chopra meditation challenge? Yes. Has anyone signed up for it? Yeah? Sorry, who was that? Deepika. You signed up for it. And how is it? It's okay. It's average. But the thing that really struck me about it, right, imagine that, Oprah Winfrey doing a meditation international course over the internet. It's quite amazing, really. But the thing that really struck me was it said that the guided meditations were approximately 16.5 minutes long. Kind of unusual way of phrasing things. But anyway, isn't that great? Can you imagine that 10 years ago or 20 years ago, to think of, you know, the world's foremost media celebrity, right, is organizing a international, you know, meditation course for free. Anyone can join in. Yeah? It's really a pretty amazing thing. Anyway. Okay, so let's begin this morning by paying respects to the Triple Gem. Okay, so welcome everybody to the second workshop for our course in early Buddhism. And last month we looked at the mostly focusing on the historical background to early Buddhism. How did this idea of early Buddhism come about? Who are some of the important figures? What are some of the important ideas, and so on? And we did a bit of a very general survey of the field, looking at some of the assumptions, some of the methods, and some of the conclusions that studies of early Buddhism have brought about. This week we're going to focus more specifically on the texts of early Buddhism. So the next three workshops will then focus on the application of those. So this week will be the most theoretical of all the workshops. So hopefully, anyway, I know some people have an aversion to theory. Well, just get over it. That's one of my advice. Okay. Now we will show by the end of it. We will have some, you know, hopefully there'll be some understanding of the practical implications and so on. But just bear with us for the time being, and we'll try to understand a bit more about exactly what these texts are, what are we talking about, okay? So remember from the first workshop that when we're talking about early Buddhism, essentially we're talking about what it is that the Buddha taught, what it is that the early generations of his disciples understood and passed down as the Dhamma. And we had a brief overview of the what we call the suttas, or the early Buddhist texts, which are essentially the only real record of what it is that the Buddha taught. And we noted that the archaeological record and so on leaves very scarce evidence, a few bits and pieces, that's all. So almost everything we know about early Buddhism we know from the texts. Of course, the texts themselves, and I can't emphasize this strongly enough, the texts themselves talk constantly about the practice of Dhamma, okay? And if one time I analyzed the text in the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya under the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the way of practice leading to the ending of suffering. So the fourth one is the practice. And about 80% of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya dealt with that fourth noble truth. Okay, so that's the kind of emphasis that the Buddha gave. That's what we find in the suttas. So don't think that, you know, studying the suttas is just a theoretical thing. No, it's not. Most of it, yes, the Buddha gives a theoretical framework, which is very important and very profound, and informs our practice, guides our practice, but most of what the Buddha is talking about is actually the practice itself. And that's why when we were looking at what are the topics to focus on when looking at the content of early Buddhist teachings, that we chose a practice framework, Sila Samadhi Panya, ethics, meditation and wisdom, as the main framework. That wasn't because of any bias or anything like that, it was because that's that's actually the thing which is taught the most and emphasized the most in the early Buddhist texts, okay? So what are we going to look at this week? We're going to look at a bit more detail at the, first of all, what we have in the textual tradition and what these things consist of. And that's going to be mainly this morning's, both the teaching and the discussion. And then this afternoon, we're going to get into the anatomy of text criticism. Okay, so I'm going to give you the scalpels and the tools for taking apart suttas. And then I'm going to give you some suttas and I'm going to get you to do some trial anatomy tests to see whether you can dissect them and see what comes out of that. Okay? Cruelty-free, of course, right? But that's what we're going to do. Okay, so here's survey of the general text. So there'll be some repetition here, but I'm deliberately repeating some material because most of you will have forgotten most of the things we talked about last time anyway, because we're not as good at memorizing things as they were in those days, right? Okay. Pali, we have the Pali Tripitaka, the Pali Canon, which is our main source of information about early Buddhism and always will be, okay? It's the only complete collection. It's the only collection which preserves in its entirety in an early Indic language. And it's the only collection which is extremely consistently and well edited and well understood. So it has always been and will always be our primary source of information about early Buddhism. Having said which, also we have, but there are some problems with the Pali tradition. One problem with the Pali tradition is that there's a very late manuscript tradition, okay? Because the Theravada Pali canon was passed down through Theravada countries. The Theravada countries tend to be in South Asia, tropical countries. Manuscripts don't last, right? It's hot and sticky and damp, and manuscripts rot and they decay very quickly. So we have very, very few manuscripts in Pali that date beyond anything older than a couple of hundred years. There's a few things older than that. There's, I think, one Pali manuscript which is in Tibet, actually. And the reason why it's in Tibet, and that's from about the 12th century, carried to Tibet by a Sri Lankan monk and preserved there because, well, manuscripts last in Tibet. They don't last in Sri Lanka. That's just the way it goes. There's also a few inscriptions and things like brass and copper plates. So some engravings on copper plates, I think from Burma, maybe 6th or 7th century, which are about the oldest Pali manuscripts known, okay? So the physical evidence for the Pali canon is fairly late. However, for a number of grounds, we know that the canon must have been redacted much earlier. There are, of course, differences in the different manuscript traditions. Normally, when we're reading the Pali, if we're doing it from a modern perspective, usually we rely on edited texts, typically those of the Pali Text Society. You remember in the last workshop, we looked at Thomas Rhys Davids' establishment of the Pali Text Society. Okay, so they collected manuscripts from Thailand, Sri Lanka, and Burma, edited and collated them, and recorded them with the variant readings. Okay. So that's a good technique and a good practice. The texts of the Pali Text Society, unfortunately, aren't necessarily all that great. They vary quite a lot in quality. Some of them are excellent, some of them are not very good. It depends on the particular editor at the time, and a lot of them were published 100 years ago and they've never been corrected or updated since that time. So they're not an ideal resource, but that's been the main source for academic work, the study of Buddhism. These days, personally, I prefer to use a digital edition of the Pali Canon that was put together by a Thai group a few years ago, which is a much more consistent and well-edited version. But when dealing with manuscripts, of course, consistent and well-edited doesn't mean better, because the manuscripts themselves aren't necessarily consistent and well-edited. Okay, so this is a kind of a debate within the academic community. Do we pass down texts which reflect some kind of ideal, perfect version of the Pali Canon where everything's spelt properly and everything's consistent? Or do we accurately reflect the manuscript tradition, which has inconsistencies and misspellings and mistakes made by the scribes and so on? So this is a kind of an ongoing issue in academic studies. But anyway, so we have the Pali Canon. Then we have the Chinese. Okay, so Early Buddhist material in Chinese, there's a lot of it. In fact, there's much more than there is in Pali. I'll just briefly come and show you what we have. Okay, so this is a list, and I was just working on this the other day for a website that I'm putting together, but this is an actual list on one page where we get pretty much all of the early Buddhist materials listed here on one page. You can see down here we have the Pali Suttas, the five Nikayas, and their equivalents in Chinese. We'll have a bit look a bit later at all of these ones and see what they are, but you can see that in the Chinese we not only have the equivalents of the Pali Virgagama, Majjhima Agama and so on, the equivalents of the Pali Nikayas, but we also have sometimes repetitions of them. So you might have like a whole collection and then a partial collection as well. And in addition, there's a number of miscellaneous and extra suttas and things like that. There's also the Sanskrit texts, which also have various passages, and Tibetan and other things. These are actually usually just fragments. Okay. So now for today, I'm going to focus mainly on the suttas, but we should also just mention that in addition to the suttas, we have the Vinaya texts, the monastic discipline. Pali, we have one complete Vinaya. Sanskrit, we have a lot of materials, and Chinese, here you can have the Chinese Vinayas. Okay, Mahasanghika Vinaya, Mahishasika Vinaya, Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, Sarvasivada Vinaya, Sarvasivada Vinaya, and others. So there's a lot. So if you're fascinated by Vinaya, you've got a life, multiple lifetimes of work there to, none of them being translated into English or anything like that. Yes?
There's more in the Pali. If the Pali texts are the most complicated and solid, why are there more in the Chinese? And so there are some extra things and things like that.
Yep. There's more in the Chinese because the Chinese were very, the Sri Lankan Buddhism, or at least the Buddhism which is passed down to us, is very, it's very kind of clearly defined, right? So the monastery which we know as Theravada actually is based in a monastery called Mahavihara in Sri Lanka, right? And Mahavihara kind of defined itself early on as the preserver of the orthodox original teachings, right? And so they rejected everything else. Actually, in Sri Lanka, they had many other monasteries, the Bhagiri Vihara, the Jetavana Vihara, and they had a lot of other different forms of Buddhism which came into Sri Lanka. And in fact, several of these texts in the Chinese canon were actually taken to China from Sri Lanka. Okay, so they only exist now in Chinese and not in Sri Lankan. So the Mahavihara basically rejected all of those other texts, which have now died away in the Theravadan tradition, and so they just kept the one tradition, right? So that's why we have that full comprehensive tradition in the Pali. So what we have in the Chinese is much more things, but more bits and pieces from different schools. So many of these sutta collections all come from different schools. The Vinayas are collected from various schools. So Mahasanghika Vinaya, different school of Vinaya, Mahishasika Vinaya was actually brought from Sri Lanka to China, doesn't exist in Sri Lanka anymore. So these are another complete Vinayas of different schools. So mostly they're similar, right? So mostly it's repeating a lot of the same information, but of course there's always variations among them. The Dharmaguptaka Vinaya is the one which the Chinese Sangha, in theory, actually practices. But they also have all of these other ones as well. So they were very kind of omnivorous. It seems that the Chinese just took in everything. Right? They didn't discriminate. They just brought in everything they could and translated everything that they could. And they didn't have this idea that, you know, there's like one true thing. But what they did is that they then, as they got all of these different texts, because as well as these, of course, then they had all the Mahayana texts and so on as well. But then they developed these philosophical schools that harmonized all of these different teachings and so on, put all of them in their place and so on, so that they can understand what the relationship is between them. Yeah. So Tibetan tradition did that also to some degree. They also have texts from various schools, but they tended to winnow things down a little bit more than the Chinese did, so that they don't have like multiple translations of the same thing. They tended to sort of aim to get one official translation. Yeah,
whatever translated from Pali to Chinese,
yeah.
the content is it the same something has been added or
pretty much it seems that with the Chinese translators were pretty straight. Okay, now there's been some suggestions in a few places that the Chinese might have added some things, but I haven't seen any really convincing evidence. As far as I can see, throughout all the suttas, they basically just translated what they had in front of them. And, you know, you occasionally find some things where the Indian text will say mango and the Chinese text will say peach. Okay, so there'll be some things like that. But basically they translate everything as well as they could. The problem is not that there was any bias or anything with the translators. The problem is that Chinese and Sanskrit or Pali are very different kinds of languages. So it's actually, because Chinese is a monosyllabic language, it doesn't have the same kind of declensions and conjugations that Pali has. So it's very difficult to capture all of the nuances of the original text in the translation. So when there's a text which exists, so I should just mention that most of these texts which are translated into Chinese, they were translated from various Indic languages, and we don't always know what the original was, okay? So in some cases we do. Mahasangika would have been translated from what they call Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. Mahishasika, we don't really know. Dharmaguptaka, probably from Gandhari. Sarvastivada would have been translated from Sanskrit, Mula Sarvastivada from Sanskrit. So most of them weren't translated from Pali as such, but they're from dialects which are very, very similar to Pali. It didn't really matter. Actually, the Chinese usually just refer to all the different languages by the same name, right? So that's why we don't know what the actual dialect was. So they're actually very similar. But anyway, in Tibetan, apparently, now I don't know Tibetan, but apparently in Tibetan, it is possible to capture the grammatical nuances of the Indic languages, even though Tibetan's not related to the Indic languages, but you can actually capture the grammar more precisely in Tibetan. So when scholars are working with these texts, they usually would prefer to work with a Tibetan translation. If there's Tibetan and Chinese translations, they usually prefer to work with a Tibetan translation as the primary source and then check it against the Chinese, rather than the other way around. So that's the main problem that we face with the Chinese translation, is just that there's just a very different idiom in how they approach using language. It's much more kind of associative in terms of associations of ideas rather than things being determined by grammatical forms. So it's possible. But when you read the Chinese text, and we'll have a look at some in a short while, it's usually, if you're reading the Chinese text side by side with the Pali or Sanskrit equivalent, it's usually very easy to figure out, you know, what the point of it is, right? You can see the vocabulary that's used and you can see what they would have been translating. But you can't see things on a very fine detail, right? You've lost a lot of the granularity, you lost a lot of the resolution that you have with the Pali texts, you know, the precision of the terminology. And so on, which we get used to in reading the Pali texts, has often been lost in the Chinese translations. Yeah.
How does English compare in nuance?
I think English is pretty good. You can usually capture the Pali texts pretty well with English. Yeah. I mean, the main issue with English, I think, is that there are some a few terms where there's quite a different like idiom or sort of. Where you're coming from is quite different. So say we're like Dhamma, you know, it's very difficult to find something in English, or meditation words like Jhana. So it's more like an inadequate vocabulary for some things in English. But generally speaking, it's not particularly problematic translating Pali into English. Yeah. Remember that with the languages we're dealing with, the Pali and Sanskrit are the oldest and best understood and analyzed languages that exist anywhere. Right? The Paninis grammar, written, I mentioned this last time, Paninis grammar written short or composed shortly after the life of the Buddha, is one of the greatest intellectual achievements of humanity of any kind. And he basically came onto the scene and wrote an absolutely perfect theoretical description of the grammar of a highly complex language out of nowhere, right? I mean, obviously there must have been a tradition, but we have this thing. It's dated at the 4th century BC, and essentially it's perfect, right? Grammar hasn't improved, it hasn't changed. That describes what the Sanskrit language is. So these languages are very, very well understood and have been for a long time. So there's no no huge, insurmountable problems in translating them. I mean, obviously there's details, and scholars like to argue about stuff because that's how they get to keep their job. But in terms of the main understanding of it is actually quite well established. I should just make a mention just briefly. I'm not going to talk about the languages too much, but with the Chinese texts, the Chinese idiom obviously is very different to modern Chinese idiom. You're talking about a language that's 1500 years old. Now, if you compare with English, it's not like Shakespeare. It's not like, that's like 500 years old. It's not even like Chaucer, which is close to 1,000 years old. It's more like Beowulf or something like that. They're old English. You read it, you really haven't got a clue what's going on. Ancient Chinese is not quite as incomprehensible as Beowulf is, but if you show an ancient Chinese sutta to someone who speaks Chinese natively, they'll be kind of perplexed. On the other hand, if you're familiar with the Pali suttas and with the Buddhist suttas, then you'll be able to make sense of it quite easily, because you'll be familiar with the idioms and the way of thought. The characters used are almost always the same. But in many cases the meaning might have changed. And another one of the problems we have in the Chinese is that they use the Chinese characters to represent the sounds of Pali names or Sanskrit names, and because the characters say the same, but the sounds change a lot in Chinese. Yeah? So in modern Mandarin, for example, the word for Buddha is four, which actually is from the word Buddha, right? B becomes P, P becomes F, yeah? The last consonant drops off, so it becomes Buddha becomes Bud, and then the last consonant then drops off, and the U changes to an O, so Buddha actually changes to four. And that's a kind of, if you don't know, then it seems like a completely different word, but actually it's the same word. All right, so Vinaya. I'm not going to talk much about the Vinaya, but just so you know, there's a lot of stuff there. And the Vinaya is very interesting, not just from the perspective of monastic conduct, but it's very interesting because the Vinaya is the most sort of grounded. It's the only place that talks in detail about toilets, right? In the Buddhist scriptures, if you want to know about how people use toilets, then there's whole chapters in the Vinaya on toilets and shoes and all of that kind of stuff, right? So that's where you get all that interesting things, right? If you want things very unconcrete and very ungrounded, then you want the Abhidhamma, right? That's the theoretical aspect of Buddhism. Everything's abstracted and it's all these ideas. So again, we have multiple Abhidhamma texts. Pali, you have a collection of 7 Abhidhamma texts. In Chinese, we have these first 7 from the Savasivadin school. So that's a complete set of the 7 Savasivadin Abhidhamma texts. And this one is from the Dharmaguptaka school, Shariputra Abhidharma. And whereas the suttas are almost about 80% the same across the different schools, the Abhidhammas are maybe 80% different. There is some things that are held in common. For example, this text here, the Vibhanga, is mainly an explanation of the important doctrinal teachings we find in the suttas, especially the Samyutta Nikaya, such as the 5 aggregates, 6 senses, dependent origination, the Eightfold Noble Path, the 4 Noble Truths, and so on. And similar explanations of those same teachings are also found in the Dharmaskanda in Chinese translation, and the same text is also found partially in a Sanskrit text. So there are important things which are common among the Abhidhamma traditions, but mostly they're in sort of independent, kind of theoretical, abstract descriptions and analysis of the material we find in the suttas. So again, I won't focus too much on the Abhidhamma, but this is just to give you just an idea of what there is. Most of the Abhidhamma would date from about 200 to 400 years after the Buddha. The Vinaya, I would date the Vinaya starting from the time of the Buddha and being mostly finished by 200 or 300 years after the Buddha. So Vinaya is somewhat later than suttas, and the suttas, I would say, is mostly from the time of the Buddha and pretty much finished by about 100 years after the Buddha, maybe a bit later. Okay. So that's just a survey of what's in all the canonical collections. Yeah?
How do we know that the Abhidharma is not as old as the suttas?
Okay, how do we know that the Abhidhamma is not as old as the suttas? We know that for multiple reasons. One reason is because of the place it has in the canon. Okay, so it's structured and organized within the canon as a subsequent collection to the suttas, right? So that's one indication. Another indication is that whereas the suttas claim to be spoken by the Buddha, the Abhidhamma doesn't claim to be spoken by the Buddha. Okay, later generations say it was, but the texts themselves don't make that claim. Third reason we know is because in some of the early Abhidhamma texts, especially this one, the Vibhanga, they have two sections. Okay, so I mentioned before that Vibhanga, what it does is it analyzes important teachings found in the suttas. Okay, so let's say a teaching like the Four Noble Truths. Right? So what the Vibhanga will do is it will take up a section on the Four Noble Truths and it will quote from a sutta. Right, so this again is how we know that it's later, because it's referring to the suttas as an earlier source. But it also will divide its analysis in two. And Vibhanga treats all of these subjects in a twofold analysis. The first one is the Suttanta Bhajaniya, is the analysis according to the sutta. Right? And the second part of the analysis is called the Abhidhamma Bhajaniya, is the analysis according to the Abhidhamma. Yeah? And when we look at those two things, clearly it's differentiating those, and clearly the Abhidhamma comes later. But also you can see that there's a different mode of analysis that comes in with the Abhidhamma Bhajaniya. It's a much more abstract kind of analysis. It's much more complex and much more, if you like, much more pedantic, whereas the sutta analysis tends to be much more pragmatic. Yeah? There's quite a different, I mean, I can go into details as the difference, but that's some of the main reasons why we know that.
Is it always dealing with concepts that arise in the suttas? Is it bringing up new stuff?
In the early phases of the Abhidhamma, it is always dealing with concepts found in the suttas, and its purpose is to define and understand that. But as it goes on, that process of abstraction goes further and further, so it starts to actually present schemes and ways of looking at things which are abstracted from what you found in suttas but are not specifically found in the suttas themselves. Okay? And I'll just give you an example of this. One of the key Abhidhamma controversies, because of course these different Abhidhammas represent the different perspectives that emerged in the schools from about 200 to 300 years after the Buddha. Right? One of the controversies was this. The Buddha taught about do good things, right? Kusala supasampada, right? You should do what's good, yeah? Sabba papasa akaranam, you shouldn't do what is bad. So it's good and bad, right? It's very basic in Buddhism, right? Well, one of the things that the Abhidhamma schools argued about is there a third category? That's where things get interesting. Good and bad is boring, right? We all know good and bad, black and white and stuff. Okay, do good, don't do bad. Well, that's easy, right? But is there anything that's kind of not quite good or bad, right? And we start to think about those kinds of things. Like, what about a cup, for example? Is a cup good or bad? Right? We don't kind of think of cups in that kind of way. Is it kind of morally good or bad? What about the Dewey Decimal System? Right? Is that morally good or bad, or not the kind of thing that has a kind of moral quality to it? Or what about Nibbana? Right? Is Nibbana good? We certainly don't think of Nibbana as bad, but is Nibbana really good in that kind of sense? So this is something which is the different Abhidhamma schools argued about, and then they came up with different solutions to that. The Theravadan solution was that there was a third category. They called Avyakata Dhamma. So the Pali Abhidhamma begins with the three categories: Kusala Dhamma, Akusala Dhamma, Avyakata Dhamma. The good Dhammas, bad Dhammas, and undeclared, undefined, right? And that includes cups and the Dewey Decimal System and Nibbana, right? They are all in Avyakata Dhamma according to the Theravadins, right? But they didn't actually mention the Dewey Decimal System as such, right? But like abstract concepts and so on, which don't have any kind of ethical quality to them. So you can see that process where it's sort of getting, it's much more about that kind of abstract categorizing. And so on. Which is, I mean, it's quite interesting. I probably shouldn't go into it too much, but it's quite interesting to see that kind of that process. You know, it actually emerges from a process of inquiry. You know, say, well, is this? You know, the Buddha said this at one place, and he said that at one place. You know, how do those two statements relate to each other? And so there's that kind of process of questioning and inquiry, which is how the Abhidhamma evolved. And in fact, most of the Abhidhamma, what's very characteristic of the Abhidhamma text, is that they're presented in the form of questions and answers. Yeah, so it arose out of that process of the dialogue and questioning in the community. Yeah. Yes?
All the suttas were spoken by Buddha or later on?
Most of the suttas, come back to the Pali Canon, that's a good question. Most of the suttas that we find, most of them are attributed to the Buddha, okay? So most of them it says this is what the Buddha said, or it assumes that, okay? So in a lot of the cases it just abbreviates and you're sort of meant to assume that the Buddha spoke that, okay? There's a fair number of suttas which are attributed to disciples of the Buddha, so Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Ananda, and so on. So I don't know, maybe 10 or 20% of the suttas are attributed to disciples. And then there are a fairly small, but not insignificant number of suttas which are actually set in the time after the Buddha died. Okay? So you have some suttas, for example, which are set after the Buddha died, and then someone's having a discussion with Venerable Ananda about, well, what is the Sangha going to do now? Right? And so, yeah, so there are a number of suttas. And those ones go up to a period of about maybe 50 or 60 years after the Buddha's death. There's not very many of them, but it is quite interesting. So it certainly wasn't considered that the canon was completely closed immediately after the Buddha's death. You know, there were things added later, and those things are acknowledged as such, either in the texts themselves or in the traditional commentaries, which in several cases actually says this sutta was added at the Second Council 100 years after the Buddha or something like that.
Yeah. Were Jataka stories spoken by
the
Buddha?
No, but mostly. The Buddha probably told a few Jataka stories, but most of the Jatakas that we have come from a later time. I'll come back to that maybe in a minute. So that's just a general survey. And any more questions before we move on? We're going to look in a bit more detail at these different collections. Any more questions before we move on?
Just one question. You mentioned that the Theravadins, when they examined the state, they dropped some of the ones that were
right
in the Chinese and that. But what was the basis for dropping it? Was it because it was too far after the Buddha?
Right. It was a very kind of strong feeling. If you read the passages where the from the Theravadin commentaries, where they are just describing the origin of their school and how they came about, there's a very strong sense right from the early days of keeping like a pure, precise and very textually based form of Buddhism. Right? They kind of defined themselves in a way as the textually precise form of Buddhism. And that's even how in the early Pali text, the Dīpavamsa, when it describes the first schism. Okay? Now, the first schism in Buddhism is described in many different ways by different schools. Some people say it's because of an argument over doctrine. Some people say it's because of a personality dispute. Some people say it's because of an argument over vinaya. Now, the Theravadin point of view from the Dīpavamsa was that it was an argument over textual redaction. Okay? So the Dīpavamsa says that these guys, the Mahasanghikas, they confused their nouns and their verbs, that they said, you know, Veda no, when they should have said Veda na, right? That they added various texts, and that they but they also complained that Mahasanghikas rejected some texts, okay? And interesting thing is about that they list the texts that were rejected by the Mahasanghikas, and those texts are in fact late texts. Okay, so the Mahasanghikas rejected the ones that the Theravadins wanted to add later in, but they probably wanted to add some of their own. So there's this kind of very strong definition, self-image from the early times with the Theravadin school, that's what they were. They were the school that preserved the texts accurately, consistently, in a clear, well-defined grammar and language. And there's definitely something to that. That's not just ideology, right? If you read Mahasanghika texts in Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, then you can well understand what the ancient Theravadins were complaining about, because hybrid Sanskrit's a nightmare. It's a complete mess of inconsistent forms and stuff. It's a complete nightmare to try to read it. So Pali is definitely much cleaner and much nicer. Yeah. Alright, so so if we come back here just briefly, so we have the Pali manuscript tradition, the Chinese, mostly translated about 400, and the main source of our information from the Chinese canon is from this, from the Tripitaka Koreana, that's what they usually call it, and that dates from the 13th century. And what that is this. Let's expand that a bit. It's a Korean collection of the Tripitaka, Buddhist scriptures, carved into 81,258 wooden printed blocks in the 13th century. Alright, that's what it is. That's the picture of it. I don't know if you can see that very clearly. See if we've got a bigger photo. It's the world's most comprehensive and oldest intact version of the Buddhist canon. It's in Hanja script with no known errors in the 52,382,960 characters, organized in 1,496 titles and 6,568 volumes. Okay. So, and that's what it is, right? From the 13th century. Yep, it describes them a bit later on. We can have a look at the description of what they are. But yes, they are. They're slats of wood. The building was built especially for them. So this is a pretty kind of amazing thing. Anyway, just go on to read a little bit more about it. Each wood block measures 70 centimetres in width, 24 centimetres in length. Thickness from 2.6 to 4 centimetres. Each weighs about 3 to 4 kilograms. It's stored in a Buddhist temple in South Korea. Okay, so there's one page of it. So you can see that it's writing in the Chinese characters. It's not written in Korean script. It was carved during the Third Koreo-Khitan War. It was considered a way of bringing about a change in fortune by invoking the Buddha's help. Okay, so this is how they won the war. Alright, moving on. Okay, so then.
So the original set of woodblocks were destroyed,
yep,
in 1232. So they redid, so they were done once and then they just redid the whole lot.
Yep. Yep, so first carved in 1087, yeah.
Are they for printing from, or are they just for reading?
They're basically for reading from, yeah. They're not printing blocks, but what they've done in modern times is that you take rubbings of them. So there's three sets of complete rubbings from those blocks, and that's what's been used as the basis for our digital editions of the Chinese canon. Yeah, the main basis for it. One of those sets, one of the three original physical sets, is at ANU in Canberra. Yeah. So, okay, so it's then was redone in 16 years, and. So there's a picture, a copy of it. So that's just a copy which is used by tourists to make an inked print of it. So each block is made from birch wood from the southern islands of Korea. It was treated, soaked in seawater for 3 years, then cut, boiled in salt water, placed in the shade and exposed in the wind for 3 years, at which point they are finally ready to be carved. So pretty amazing. I mean, one of the world's most amazing, you know, cultural artifacts of any form. There are other manuscript sources for the Chinese canon, passed down in China and Japan and so on. But that's the principal source, and that's the main one on which the modern digital editions have been based. So in addition to that, the Pali and Chinese sources, we have Tibetan texts. I'm not very familiar with the Tibetan manuscript tradition, various Sanskrit texts, and other Indian languages. Most of the Sanskrit texts were recovered from Nepal or Tibet. Okay, so Buddhism, of course, was wiped out in India, the Tibetans mostly didn't keep alive a Sanskrit tradition. They translated everything in Tibetan, which actually, of course, is the Buddha's instructions. He said, translate, he said, study Dhamma in your own language, right? So the Tibetans and Chinese followed the Buddha's instructions, whereas the Sri Lankans were naughty. And they kept everything in Pali and didn't translate it into the local dialect, right? Which I'm very thankful for, right? This is the advantages of naughtiness. Okay, so, however, there are some manuscripts found. The Nepalese kept alive a bit more of a Sanskrit tradition, and a lot of the modern Sanskrit texts were recovered from Nepal, and also a few things from Tibet. For example, one of the important finds from Tibet was a copy of the Bhikshuni Vinaya from the Lokuttaravada school, and that's a manuscript which is dated to the 11th century. Okay, so it was actually brought from India to Tibet in the 11th century and then stored in the bottom of some monastery library cupboard for nearly 1,000 years before it was recovered. Many of them recovered either by a couple of the European scholars, but a lot of them recovered by an Indian monk called Rahula Sankrityayana, who travelled around Nepal and Tibet in the early mid part of the 20th century and discovered a lot of these manuscripts and took photographs of them and so on, brought them back to India, edited them and published them. So it takes an incredible amount of work to do these things. Yeah? So I'm going to come and look in some more detail at I should mention about the chance manuscript finds. So what we've been finding is both in earlier times we have some large findings of manuscripts of places like Dunhuang in western China, Gilgit, and on the Silk Road, Afghanistan and so on. And quite a lot of manuscripts have been found. Only a small percentage of them have been published. Most of the manuscript finds are of later texts, but there's a substantial amount which is also from the early suttas. Many of these are just chance finds, and a lot of them just appear on the market, right? They just come from some shonky second-hand camel dealer, right? Who comes and says, I've got a manuscript, you want to buy it, right? And they just come and no one knows where they come from, right? They're just discovered by some, you know, goat herd or something in Afghanistan, and then they try to make a bit of money out of it on the black market. So this is very, you know, a lot of times we don't know a lot about the provenance of them, where they come from. But in those cases where we do know the provenance of them, some of the Gandhari manuscripts from Afghanistan have been dug up from jars where they have been buried, and it seems that what they are is the old used manuscripts from the library, and when they wanted to copy the manuscripts, they would put the old ones in jars and bury them. And so it's those old worn out library copies which are the ones which have been recovered, and among others, Mark Allen from Sydney Uni is one of the foremost in the world in editing those, and some of those manuscripts have now been carbon dated at ANU to the 1st century AD. So these are the oldest Buddhist manuscripts that exist, and they're also the oldest Indian manuscripts of any sort that exist, okay, about 1st century AD. And those early manuscripts consist partly of early Buddhist texts and a mixture of material that you might expect from that period, some kind of Jataka stories and various kinds of things. Okay. But that's still very much an emerging field. Yeah? Only the stuff has only partly been discovered, and there's a very small group of international scholars who are working on editing and getting that material out. So I'm going to look at the different texts and the survey of what we have in a bit more detail. But before we do that, I want to just remind us all of what it is that we're looking at and what we're talking about when we mean the relationship and the connection between these things. Now, in the first workshop, we started out that with a verse. You remember we showed the verse from the Yehe to the verse of the those things originate from a cause. The target was showing the origination and the cessation too. And I showed this verse in Pali and Sanskrit and Tibetan and so on and so forth. And I want to just remind you of that and remind you of this the similarity between all of these things. Here we have a Pali verse found in Dhammapada, but also found in the Kagavisana Sutta, which was one of your reading for this workshop, the Rhinoceros Horn Sutta. And Sachela Bheta Nipatang Sahayam Sadhim Charang Sadhu Vihari Dhirang Abhibhuya Sabbani Parisayani Chareya Tenatamano Satima. So if you gain a discerning friend, wander together, living well with that wise one, overcoming all obstacles, you should wander with him, oneself being mindful. So this is, you know, very typical verse we find in early Buddhism. It's very down to earth, it's very straightforward, it's giving a nice, encouraging, positive, supportive kind of message. You know, it's not about kind of invoking gods and all of those kinds of things. It's a very kind of, I think, very kind of meaningful and quite moving injunction. And we find, of course, that occurs in the context of many other verses in the Rhinoceros Sutta. Here is, by way of comparison, another version of that verse. This is found in the Gandhari Dhammapada. So the Gandhari Dhammapada is one of those texts we're talking about here that the sort of chance manuscript finds, recovered, translated, and a version of the Dhammapada which is not exactly the same as the Pali Dhammapada, Sachela Bheya Nipatang Sapranyam, which I'm not quite sure, but I think that means with wisdom. Sadhim Charang Sadhu Vihara Dhirang Abhibhuya Sabani Parishra. And notice how it's broken here. So the manuscript isn't always complete. So again, this is why I was saying that with the Pali manuscript, we have an extraordinarily complete, well-edited version. Okay, and with all of these Sanskrit ones, and this one we have pretty much all of it, but there's still some missing. Chareya tenatamano satima. Okay, so again, you compare with the Pali, sachela bheta nipatang sahayam sadhim charam sadhu vihari dihiranga vipuyab sabbani parisayani chareya tenatamano satima. And then you can see very easily that the Sanskrit version is almost exactly the same. And again, we're not talking about a generic similarity of ideas. We're talking about word-for-word text that is identical with only a couple of variations. And I think the only meaningful variation here is this one has sapranyam, which I'm not quite sure what that means in Gandhari, but I suspect it probably means with wisdom. I'm not familiar with Gandhari. And in the same one, the Pali has Sahayam, which means a friend. Okay? So you translate, if you gain a discerning one with wisdom, something like that. But I might be mistaken about the translation of that, I'm not quite sure. Actually, just while we're on that one, some of you probably... You're probably familiar enough with the Dhammapada. That this will make a difference. Here we go. So this one was called the Patna Dhammapada from its finding place. So here's the Sanskrit text of it. Some of you, especially our Sri Lankan friends, will know many of the Dhammapada verses in Pali, won't you? Yes, very good. So here's the first verse. Mano purvangama dharma, mano shreshtra, mano java. Manashata chapadushtena bahashate va karoti va tatonan dukham anneti chakrang va vahato padam. Sounds familiar? But a bit strange at the same time, yeah? And then the other verse, again the same, and then Ihas shochati, precious shochati, papa kammo ubhayatas shochati, so shochati, so vihangati, vrishta kama kilesham attano. You remember that one? He grieves beyond, he grieves the one who does evil, he grieves in both places, yeah? So he grieves and laments when he sees the evil karma that he's made himself. Yeah? And then the opposite verse, here he delights, there he delights, he rejoices, the one who's done good rejoices in both places, and so on. Here's another one. Akroshimang avadhimang Ajini mang ahasi me ye tani upanai hanti verang teshang na shamyati. Anyone want to translate that for me? Go on. Sorry? He abused me, yeah? Reviled me, something like that, yeah? He did me wrong. That man done me wrong. So if you keep on thinking that way, then you never find peace, yeah? But when you let go of those things, then verang pesang ushaya upashamyati. Yeah? So again, exactly the same as the Pali verses. Here's the verse that I quoted from earlier, Sachela Bhaya Nipakansahayam, and so on and so on. So here's another very famous one. Apramado amatang padang, pramado machuno padang, apramatta na mriyanti, ye pramatta yathamatta. Yeah? Recognize that? Yeah? Who wants to translate it? Just give a rough translation.
Apramado amatang means if you are diligent or you practice dharma, I guess it is your literal meaning.
Yeah.
Do not die.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you get enlightened.
Mm.
Pramado machino padam pramadeo practicing dhamma leads to death.
Yeah.
Machino means death. Pamatta means ye pamatta. So I guess practice the dhamma diligently without delay.
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah. Right, that's good, yeah. So literally, the first one is literally that heedfulness is the way to the undead. So if you want to become a zombie, then you practice the Dhamma. Yeah. I'm not sure if that's the original meaning, but anyway, sometimes you can be a bit too literal with these things. So. Okay, but again, you can see how, you know, again, that a connection between them is not just a thematic connection, it's not just an affinity of ideas, right? It's the same verse, right? With a slightly different accent. So it's very important just to bear this in mind and remember that's what we're talking about. When we're talking about these early Buddhist texts, in the Chinese, Sanskrit and so on, that's what we're talking about. Yeah? And we can go on. And of course there are some verses here which are not found in the Pali Dhammapada and vice versa. Some verses found in this one which you might find in the Pali text somewhere, but they're not in the Dhammapada, right? So the collections are organized in slightly different ways, but basically it's the same thing. Okay. So this is, if anyone's interested in this is the website called Gretel. You can just Google Gretel and you'll find it, and it has a lot of both Pali texts, but also Sanskrit and other texts available there. Okay, so we have half an hour to go. So in the next half an hour that we've got in this session, I want to give an overall survey of some of these major collections. Okay, now when I'm going to be naming these ones, and so we usually call these the Digha Nikaya and Majjhima Nikaya and so on in Pali, but I'm just going to call them Agamas, because just to keep it simple, so I don't have to keep saying Nikaya and Agama. Actually, if you look in the Pali commentarial tradition, most of the time they actually refer to them as Agamas. It seems to be the older term. And it's less confusing because the word Nikaya also means a school of Buddhism. So it can be a little bit confusing to use the word Nikaya. So anyway, I'm just going to call them Agamas just for the sake of consistency. Okay, so the Digha Agama, long discourses, we have 34 suttas in Pali. The emphasis is on the teaching to Brahmins and non-Buddhists. So here's the Digha Nikaya, translation here by Maurice Walsh. Published through the Wisdom Publications. In the Chinese version of this, we have 30 suttas. The translation was made by Buddha Hishas and Shu Fonin in 413 CE, and it belongs to the Dharmaguptaka school. Notice how there's often more than one translator. What usually you'd find with the translations into Chinese is that they were done by a team. Typically, there might be one Indian monk who would have the original text and would either recite it from memory or would have the manuscript and read the manuscript, and then you'd have a Chinese monk who would be then putting it into the Chinese, and then you'd have maybe some scribes, maybe some editors and correctors and so on. And so there'd be a small team of maybe four or five people who worked on most of these translations. And these names are usually recorded at the beginning of the actual translation itself, right? So we actually have, at the beginning of the Dirghagama, it'll have a little note saying this translation was done in the year such and such of the reign such and such of the Chinese emperor such and such by so and so and so and so together with so and so and so and so. So all that information is recorded in the text themselves. And because we have a very good understanding of Chinese history, they get great historical records and so on, so we know the dates of these things fairly precisely, much more precisely than we know any Indian dates. And in addition to these two, the other extant one is a Mula Sarvasivada or Sarvasivada text, which is in Sanskrit, and it's not published, but is one of these ones which kind of appeared on the back of a camel somewhere, and there's about 55% of it exists, okay, and it's in the hands at the moment of a group of German scholars. Now you can imagine this thing's, you know, it's like 1500 years old, right? So you can't sort of open it up and read it, right? You have to somehow peel, and it's like a kind of rolled thing, right? So you have to somehow peel each one off, so that you're not going to disintegrate everything as soon as you touch it, right? And then you have to sort of photograph every leaf, and then you have to distribute those leaves to scholars who know that language and the script and so on, and then you have to go through very carefully and sort of transcribe it with all the errors and omissions and everything that involves. So that's going to be a long process. A few little partial passages and so on have appeared, and we know some information about it, but that's something that will be emerging, I guess, in the next couple of decades, probably. Okay. Now, Dirghagama is a very interesting collection, and it's a very fun collection. Dirghagama, the guys who put this together were kind of a bunch of hippies. They use these kind of, it's where you start to see this much more kind of playful and elaborate set of narrative styles and literary forms which are being used to express the Dhamma, whereas a lot of the shorter collections is quite dry. It's just a kind of bare statement, this is what the teaching is, and the Dirghagama you find a lot of elaborate parables, quite amusing stories. I mean, sometimes it descends into outright kind of farce, a lot of it is also dialogues with non-Buddhists. So it seems that rather than being something which was intended primarily as teachings for Buddhists, it was something which is intended more as a record and a way of relating to non-Buddhists and so on. I'll give you here a typical example from the Digha Nikaya, and this is from the Sakkapanya Sutta. So this is one of the great suttas in the Digha Nikaya, and it's a great sutta because it combines both of those aspects. It has both a completely outrageous literary framework, as well as some very lovely and profound teachings in the heart of it. I'll just give you a little. I won't read the whole sutta, but just give you a couple of examples of that. So this is Digha Nikaya number 21, the Sakkapanha Sutta, translated as Sakka's Questions here by Maurice Walsh, and it concerns the time when the Buddha was staying in Magadha, the east of Rajagaha, by a Brahmin village called Ambasanda, to the north of the village on Mount Vedya in the Indasala cave. And that cave is still, well, anyway, we think we know where that cave is in the Rajagaha region. And then Sakka, the king of the gods, wanted to visit the Buddha, but he decided that it was hard for somebody like him to see the Buddha, which is kind of weird in itself, because there's plenty of other cases where Sakka went to see the Buddha. But anyway, so he went to Panchasika of the Gandhabas. And Panchasika of the Gandhabas he said, you go and attract the Buddha's attention for me. So they're kind of setting up this whole kind of narrative framework already, right? So all of these gods want to go and see the Buddha, but the Buddha's kind of quite busy and stuff. You have to make an appointment, and then you've got to figure out the right way to see him, and we'll get the guitar player to go and see him. This is why I like the sutta, because it's about a guitar player, right? And then Panchasika goes down to see him, and it's not just like he goes to visit the Buddha, but all the villagers around saw the radiance that the god made when he descended, and they said, oh, the hills are on fire, right, because of the radiance of the gods, and all their hair stood on end. So So Saka asked Panchasika to go and attract the ear of the Buddha so that he could go and have a conversation with him afterwards. So then Panchasika took his guitar, his yellow Beluwa wood lute, and approached the Indasala cave thinking, well, as long as I should get to a place where I'm neither too far nor too near the Lord, and then he'll hear my voice. And he stood to one side, and then to the strains of his lute, he sang these verses extolling the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Arahants, and love. So this is the only love song in the Pali canon, okay? And it starts out, here's it. Lady, your father Timburu greet, O sunshine fair, I give him honour due, by whom I was sired a maid as fair as you, who are the cause of all my heart's delight. So he's trying to kind of woo this maiden, but he also has to convince the father that he's an appropriate suitor for this maiden. Delightful as the breeze to one who sweats, or as a cooling draught to one who thirsts, your radiant beauty is to me as dear as the Dhamma is to Arahants. And this goes on kind of like that. Come, embrace me, maiden fair of thighs. Seize and hold me with your lovely eyes. Take me in your arms, is all I ask. My desire was slight at first, O maid, of waving tresses, but it grew and grew as grow the gifts that Arahants receive. Just like the Sakyan son, wrapped in jhana, intent and mindful, seeks the deathless goal, so too I seek your love, my son. And so on and on it goes. So, I think that's very cool. So what do you do, right? If you're the Buddha, huh? And then somebody comes up and sings you this song, how do you respond? Okay? Okay, well, when he heard this, the Buddha said, Panchasika, the sound of your strings blends so well with your song, and your song with the strings, that neither prevails excessively over the other. That's quite sweet, isn't it? Yeah, he sort of didn't say, didn't tell him off, managing to give him quite a nice kind of compliment. When did you compose these verses on the Buddha, the Dhamma, Arahants, and love? And so then he goes on and tells the story and so on. So, and that kind of whole background goes on, and we hear the kind of the kind of melodrama of Panchasika's relationship and so on and so forth. Later on, when Saka comes to ask his question, he says, by what fetters are beings bound, whatever kind of beings there are, whereby although they want to live without hate, without harming, without hostility, and in peace, and yet they live in hate, harming one another, hostile and malign. So this is when it comes to the actual Dhamma part of it. Yeah? And of course, very powerful question, isn't it? Yeah? Very powerful, very profound, and very meaningful question. So then the Buddha's response, Lord of the gods, it is through the bonds of jealousy and avarice that binds beings so that though they wish to live without hate, they still live in hate. And then Saka goes on and says, well, what gives rise to jealousy and avarice? What is their origin? And goes on asking more and more questions, and they go into more detail about where these things come from and so on. And so, you know, that's a very good example of the typical style we find in the Digha Nikaya, where the core is quite profound, a very beautiful Dhamma, but dressed up. Yeah? The Digha reciters like to dress things up a little bit. Not all of them are like that, but quite a few places we find that kind of literary style emerging.
Okay, what sutra is that?
That's the Sakapanha Sutta, Digha Nikaya 21. You just want to read the whole love song, right? So the next collection, so this is just, I'm just going through the collections in the order that they're usually found in the Pali canon. The Madhyama Agama, middle-length discourses, here we have it in the excellent translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, based on the translation by Bhikkhu Nyanamoli, the English monk. 152 suttas in the Pali. The main emphasis in the Madhyama Nikaya is on the doctrine, central doctrines of Buddhism, like a dialogue or exchange. So most of the suttas here are dialogues between the Buddha and usually other monks or other practitioners and so on. And it's quite a varied collection. There's a lot which have him in like discussions with non-Buddhists, but also a lot with discussions with the other, with Sangha and so on. And many of the suttas tend to be very sort of pitched at quite a high level. It's good, many kind of profound suttas dealing with very advanced states of meditation and these kinds of things, but also a very strong practical emphasis, a lot on ethics and meditation techniques and so on. So this is really kind of the main source work in many ways for sort of the heart of Buddhist teachings in terms of meditation and things like that. The Majjhima Nikaya. The Majjhima Agama in Chinese, we have a version of that, 222 suttas, translated by Sangadeva, 397 to 398. The extra suttas are mostly ones which in the Pali collection would be found in the Anguttara Nikaya or somewhere else. There's a few suttas there which are not found anywhere in Pali, but most of them are found somewhere. They're just not found in the Majjhima Nikaya. So this is what we, you know, we find that the organization of these things is a bit different between the different collections, but on the whole, most of the content is the same. The Majjhima Agama is the only one of these early collections for which we have comprehensive comparative studies. And there's been two major studies completed for this. The first one was by the Vietnamese monk Thich Minh Chao in the 1960s. And he did an excellent study, which I believe we have here in the library. But that has, even though that's an excellent study, but it's been superseded by Venerable Analio's recent publication, A Comparative Study of the Majjhima Nikaya. And that's a really excellent book. I can't recommend it strongly enough. And if you really do want to study the Majjhima Nikaya seriously, definitely get that book and read it in conjunction with Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Yeah. And what you'll find when you're reading it is that, you know, it's just really useful just to as a reference point. And very often, most of the time you read it and you look at the comparative study and actually pretty much the same. Yeah. And occasionally it might clear up a few points of confusion or something like that. But the main thing, you know, the main message you get from these is that actually, at the end of the day, they're pretty much the same. So none of these have been translated. None of the Chinese agamas have been translated into English. In fact, the only one which is imminent is the Majjhima Agama. It's been translated again by Analio, my friend Rod Bucknell, and Marcus Bingenheimer. And now they have mostly completed a translation of the Majjhima Agama, and that's due for publication in 2014. So that will be it's quite incredible. That will be the first time that any substantial early Buddhist collection from Chinese has ever been translated into a modern language. Right? I mean, it's quite shocking, really. I mean, we've been studying Buddhism in the modern era for 150 years, translated pretty much all of the Pali Canon. And from Chinese, just a few bits and pieces, yeah? A few isolated suttas and things, but no complete collections. Okay. So, Nyutta Agama, the connected discourses. Suttas arranged according to the central doctrines of Buddhism. Now, according to a theory which I developed in a book, A History of Mindfulness, and also in which was following on some work of some other scholars, like Master Yin Shun, the great Taiwanese scholar, then the Nyutta Agama may be considered to be the first sort of structured collection, a canonical collection in Buddhism. I don't want to go on too much on the implications of that. It doesn't mean that the texts there are necessarily earlier than the texts found elsewhere, but it means that the structure is a bit more fundamental. Now we have the Pali Nyutta Agama, which is here. Bhikkhu Bodhi's, again, excellent translation, published through Wisdom Publications. One full Chinese translation by Gunabhadra, and two partial Chinese translations. Again, Venerable Analio, who is the powerhouse in this area, started translating the Nyutta Agama, and we actually have the first few of his translations available already. So we're going to be putting this on the website I showed you earlier, Sutta Central. We're going to be putting Analio's translations on there very soon. Okay, so these two partial translations are... I should have mentioned this earlier, actually. We'll come back to the Dīrghāgama. Now, what we find in the Chinese, we don't just find the 30 suttas of the Dīrghāgama. How the Chinese canon is organized is that it begins with the Dīrghāgama, that's the first text in it, okay? And then Then there's about, 24 suttas, 25 suttas, which are individual suttas, okay? Not a collection, but individual suttas, and those are individual suttas translated from Dīrghāgama suttas, okay? So it's 25 suttas from various places, but they're just like miscellaneous translations of individual suttas. They're not whole collections. And often we know a lot less about those than we do about the collections. It's very hard to determine what school they come from, their background, and so on. So you can imagine a situation where you have, a translation of the Majjhima Nikaya by Bhikkhu Bodhi, but also down through the years, individuals have translated various suttas from the Majjhima Nikaya, right? And then, you know, you found them floating around on the internet in various places. You didn't really know where they came from or who did them. But anyway, you collected them all and put them as an appendix here in the Majjhima Nikaya, right? So that's the situation that we find in the Chinese canon. As well as the main collections, we also find various kind of miscellaneous and independent ones. And they've been even less studied than the main collections.
Okay. There's a sense in the Samyutta that you've got a collection of fragments, not complete stories, not complete teachings.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Padiga and the Majjhima, they present as more complete teachings.
Yeah.
Is that reasonable summary?
Definitely, yeah. In both the Samyuttagama and the Anguttara Nikaya, we have the suttas are much shorter, and there's a combination. I mean, I think a lot of the suttas there do, you know, read like complete texts, but a lot of them, as you say, read like fragments. And it's in fact almost certain, or I think it's quite certain, that in many cases that's exactly what they are. For example, if you look in the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Anguttara Ones, beginning of the Anguttara Ones, or the whole chapter of the Anguttara Ones is actually just fragments. Right? It's just slivers, because it's all just one thing. But very often you can see, like, there might be five things, like the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body, right? And then it'll present them in one way and then reverse it in the other way or something. But that's actually just one sutta which dealt with the five senses. Yeah? And that's been sliced up and put into the Anguttara Nikaya as 5 or 10 independent suttas. So yes, we find that kind of editorial process going on constantly, especially in the Samyutta and the Anguttara, mostly in the sort of the shorter ones, the repetition ones, and so on. There's obviously a lot of much more substantial and whole suttas there as well. Yeah. But that's definitely something to be borne in mind when considering those texts, and especially the Samyutta and the Anguttara, that often we're just dealing with a fragment. Okay, so two partial Chinese translations. Let's have a look. We're very lucky that there's been a substantial amount of one of those partial Chinese translations has been translated into English by my friend Marcus Bingenheimer. So let's have a look at that. So this is the T100, the shorter Chinese Samyutta Agama. Okay. Marcus uses the word BZA, I think it's the Bei Za Ahan Jing is the translation of the Samyutta Agama. And so he's done a great job of this. You can make a record of this website if you like. I just find it by googling Marcus Bingenheimer, BZA. Anyway, it's at buddhistinformatics.ddbc.edu.tw/BZA. Anyway, we can share that around afterwards. But this is the only available translation of really any substantial amount of things, or pretty much the only translation of any substantial amount of things from the earliest Samyutta Agamas. Now, Marcus has done a nice job with his site, and he's organized them in terms of clusters of suttas. So rather than thinking of a sutta as being something individual, he thinks in terms of, you know, the Pali, the Chinese, the Sanskrit, or whatever that we have. This is like a cluster of the text, and there's no kind of one definitive one, but what we have is that cluster. So that's what he means by a cluster there. Let's have a look at that. And we'll have a look at the first one. Oh, look, what a coincidence, the first sutta. Sujata is praised. This is why I like this particular one. This collection was compiled by a person of great sagacity and wisdom. So let's see what this one says. So, Sujata is praised. So he presents here the Chinese text. So this is the Chinese text which he's translated from. Here's the ordinary Samyutta Nikaya text. So the complete Chinese text is Samyutta Agama. So this is a separate Chinese version of the same thing, but we can also swap that around and, for example, get the Pali text for the Pali equivalent. So this is quite nice if we're doing comparative studies. Let's have a look at the sutta. Last have I heard. Once the Buddha stayed in a mango grove in the country of Mithila. Notice the setting is different, right? The Pali one, it says Savatthi and Viharati. The Buddha was dwelling in Savatthi. Okay? This is one of the things we often find, is that the framing narratives are different, whereas the texts themselves are the same. The teachings is the same, but the background story is different. Now, this time, Venerable Sujata had just gone forth and cut off his hair. He came to the Buddha, paid homage by touching the Buddha's feet, and sat down on one side. The Buddha told the other monks, "This son of a good family, Sujata, is splendid in two ways. First, his appearance is of extraordinary beauty. His features are exceptionally handsome. Second, he was able to cut off his hair and cover his body with a robe. Feeling deeply that family life was all too ephemeral, he went forth and pursued the way. He ended all afflictions, is filled with purity, has liberated his mind from desire, and has liberated his wisdom from ignorance. In this very body, he's attained the unconditioned, forever ended the cycle of birth, life and death, establishing the pure life. He will not have to endure another existence." Having said this, the Buddha spoke this verse. "The monk, always calm and concentrated, abandons desire and life and death. He abides in his final body. He can defeat Mara's armies. Training his mind, he breaks all fetters. His uprightness is without equal." When the Buddha had finished preaching this sutta, the monks, having listened to what he had said, were happy and practiced accordingly. This is a coincidence, all right? Okay. Okay, so so those who are familiar with Pali will see that the Pali text is very similar. So just to read briefly through the Pali text, the Buddha is staying at Savatthi. Then the Venerable Sujata came to where the Buddha was staying. When the Buddha saw Venerable Sujata coming in the distance, he said to the bhikkhus, "This son of a good family is beautiful in both ways. He's both incredibly handsome and good-looking, charming and endowed with the highest blessings of beauty, but also that goal of the holy life for which sons of good family rightly go forth from the home life, the unexcelled culmination of the holy life. He has seen that in this very life with his own direct knowledge, and enters on and abides that, having witnessed it with his own direct knowledge." And so this is what the Blessed One said. So actually the Chinese text here goes into a bit more detail, right? It kind of expands with a bit more of kind of that. Maybe that's a bit more of a personal background in Sujata's story that we're capturing there. The Pali one here is much more of a stock phrase. So perhaps in this case, I don't know, perhaps the Chinese one has, or whatever the original the Chinese is based on, has elaborated the story. Or perhaps the Pali instead has replaced a more personal story with a more stock phrase. Okay, sometimes that can happen. So these are some of the principles that we look when we compare these. You know, we can see, well, obviously it's telling the same story. Huh? Even the verse at the end is the same. Sovati vatayam bhikkhu udubhutena chetasa. That monk is beautiful. His upright and with his upright, straightforward mind, he's detached and not attached, and through non-grasping is attained nirvana. He bears his last body, having overcome Mara and his army. Yeah. So when we see we can see that clearly it's the same text, right? Again, like the comparisons we made before, right? It's the same verse. But there's some differences, okay? So the difference in the setting, okay? That's a kind of an interesting one. Now, when we see one sutta which is set in Savatthi and another sutta which is set in Mithila, which one do you think is more likely to be correct? Sorry? Mithila? Savatthi? Who's for Mithila? Okay, about four or five. Who's for Savatthi? Oh, Savatthi wins, right? Because that's how these things are decided, right? It's about popular vote. Now, actually, if you're familiar with the Pali Canon, you'll know that the vast majority of suttas are set at Savatthi, right? And as you can see here, when we're setting at Savatthi, is almost redundant, right? It just says Savatthi and Viharati. It doesn't even bother to say, thus have I heard at one time the Blessed One was saying in Savatthi, at Jetta's Grove and Atapindika's Park, and that time the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus and the bhikkhus replied. So all that's been abbreviated, right? It just says Savatthi and Viharati. In some places, a lot of places, it doesn't even say that much, right? It just omits it entirely. So, whereas this one is saying in Mangrove Grove in the country of Mithila. Now, it seems fairly obvious from the Pali Canon that what's happened is that a lot of suttas and teachings were just sort of conventionally placed at Savatthi, right? That, you know, perhaps they didn't really know where the setting was and so they just did it there. Interesting thing is that there's two vineyards which exist, one Mahasangika vineyard, the other Mulasarvasivada vineyard, both of which give a procedure on what you should do when you've forgotten where the sutta was taught, right? And it says, well, if you've forgotten where it's taught, just say it was at Savatthi. Right? Or somewhere like that, one of the big cities. And if you've forgotten who the name of the king was, just say it was Pasenadi or Bimbisara. Right? So you can see that these framing narratives are not so important, right? Notice what that doesn't say, okay? It doesn't say, you know, if you've forgotten whether this teaching is about dependent origination or the five aggregates, then just say it was about dependent origination, okay? Right? It's not saying that, okay? It's not saying anything about the important Dhamma. It's saying it about the incidental details, right? So those incidental details. So because of that principle seems to be followed, then this is what I call the Savatthi redaction normalization principle. Okay? So that means that the default setting for the suttas is at Savatthi, right? And probably if a sutta says it's somewhere else, it's more likely that the other location is the actual location, right? Because if there's another, they don't know, they'll put it at Savatthi. So in this case, I'd say probably more likely that it was the setting at Mithila. So sorry, majority, you're wrong. But of course, we don't know, but it's just, you know, on the whole.
Would Savatthi be in the country of Mithila?
Yeah. No, the different countries, yeah. Mithila's to the east. Mithila is more or less between Kapilavastu and Vaisali. Yeah, so it's somewhat to the east of Kosala. Yeah.
Okay, last month you mentioned the when the Buddha gave the discourse to the 500 monks in a cave. 500 was it? Well, you said the cave was too small.
That was the first council, yeah, after the Buddha died, yeah.
Yeah. Is there a parallel telling of the story which locates that somewhere else?
Not as far as I know. As far as I know, all the early sources put it at the Satapani cave. Yeah, I haven't researched that point, but that's my understanding, yeah. Okay, so that's a bit of an example of the Samyutta Agama. And we're at nearly 10:30, so I'm just going to rush through these things a little bit so we can go to the important things like tea break. Next one is the Akotra Agama, known in Pali as the Anguttara Nikaya, arranged by ascending numbers, a group of ones, a group of twos, and so on. Of course, it's a very powerful mnemonic technique for memorizing things. You know, you know that there's supposed to be five aggregates. So if you've only got four of them, hang on, one, two, three, four, hang on, I know I'm missing one somewhere, right? So it's a very, very powerful mnemonic technique. So there's a Pali collection, there's one full Chinese translation and one partial Chinese translation. The full Chinese translation was done by Dharmanandi and Sangabhadra. Actually done by Sanganandi and corrected by Sangabhadra, 397 to 398 CE. So notice how these are all very, very close in time, right? 398, this one is 413, 3 gets 97, 398, this one 435 to 433. It was in about 50-year period, and most of the vineyards are the same, that almost all the early Buddhist material was translated into Chinese. And I've never really seen an explanation for why that's so. I mean, there was things which were translated into Chinese over... oh, certainly well over 500 years, more like 700 years or something. And why it is that almost all of the early Buddhist material was translated within that 50-year period, I really don't know. But anyway, part of it may have been opening up the trade routes with Sri Lanka. That was also the period when the Sri Lankan bhikkhunis went to China and started the bhikkhuni lineage there, right? It's in that same period. So the, and some of these texts were taken from Sri Lanka. The Samyutta Agama was taken from Sri Lanka by Phasya, as was the Mahishasika Vinaya and some other texts. But that doesn't explain everything. Okay, the Kottara Agama, we have a Chinese translation, but the Chinese translation is very erratic. It diverges from the Pali a lot. The translation itself is full of problems, and it's very, very strange. Even basic Buddhist doctrines are sometimes treated quite inconsistently within the same text. It's something you don't find anywhere, right? I don't know of any other Buddhist text where you have even basic. I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but basic teachings are taught quite inconsistently, or you even find like in the same text, like this, the same term will be translated with two different ways within the same passage, or these kinds of things. Yeah, so it's a very erratic and quite a poor quality translation. But also the original text, it seemed, was very quite different from the Pali Anguttara Nikaya for reasons that we don't really understand. We don't also know the school of it. Some scholars suggest it's Mahasanghika, but it's really not known what the school of it is. Many of the suttas in the Anguttara and the Akotra don't have parallels for that reason. I mean, we assume that there probably were collections in other early schools which were more similar to the Pali collection. In fact, the partial Chinese translation is more similar to the Pali collection. I personally think that the Akotra Agama that happened to be translated into Chinese was just a very erratic text, a very eccentric text for some reason. That one. And there's substantial amounts of that has been translated by Bhikkhu Pasarika and some assistants, published in the Buddhist Studies Journal over several years. Some of those are on my website, santipada.org. You can read some of those quite nice suttas. Okay, then we have, so that's this one, the Anguttara Nikaya. The Anguttara is actually the largest of the four Nikayas. So this recent publication just came out a few months ago by Bhikkhu Bodhi, culmination of about 10 years' work. It's fantastic to have that. Okay, then we have the Kuddhika Nikaya. Kuddhika Nikaya has a lot of different books in it. I'm not sure how many, about 15 books, I think, altogether. I'm not going into all of them because many of them are later. But the important ones from early Buddhist point of view is the Dhammapada. Most of these are verses. Dhammapada is verse. Suttanipata, Udana, Iti, Wuttaka are a mixture of verse and prose, but most of the important teaching parts are in the verse. Yeah, the prose is more of the background stories and narratives. And the Tera Terigata are the verses of the monks and nuns. Okay, so the Tera Terigata is very, very interesting. It gives a much more kind of personal feel for what happened. Especially the Terigata is pretty much the oldest collection of women's spiritual literature anywhere in the world, I believe. So that's a very, very unique value. The other books of Udana Iti Wuttaka are wonderful collections. They're generally believed by scholars to be somewhat later than the teachings in the four Nikayas. But again, that mainly refers to like the details of the narrative stories and things like that, the teachings themselves probably from the same period. Suttanipata is a compilation. Some parts of it are very early, and other parts of it are quite late. And this afternoon we're going to have a look at some of the passages from that, and we're going to find ways of analysing and distinguishing those things. Just by the way, you should note that it's often said quite erroneously, and you read that some people will say that Suttanipata is regarded as being one of the earliest collections in Buddhism. This is just untrue. What's true is that there's certain parts of it which are regarded as early, but the whole collection is definitely not early. But as usual with these things, we are actually able to tell what's the earlier and later parts fairly easily. Now, in addition to those ones, then we have some things in Tibetan, and I'll just mention briefly the two main things which have been published in Tibetan. One is a collection called the Mahasutras, which has been published in a series by the Pali Text Society. The scholar is Peter Skilling, who visited Sydney a couple of years ago. and he's done an excellent job of translating this group of texts called the Mahasutras from Tibetan. Most of those Mahasutras are well-known sutras also found in the Pali Canon. They're Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, the Brahmajala Sutta, there are various paritas and so on. There's about, I think, 20 or 30 suttas in that group, which is like a recognized group of suttas within the Tibetan canon. So that's one of the important groups of early texts found in the Tibetan canon. The other important group is this text called the Upayika. The actual name of it is the Abhidharma Kosha Upayika Namatika. You got that? So we'll call it the Upayika. Upayika is a very interesting text. One of the most important texts, or possibly the most important text for study in the Tibetan and Chinese traditions, is a book called the Abhidharma Kosha, okay, which is a summary of the Abhidhamma written by a monk called Vasubandhu around 400 or so AD. Vasubandhu frequently refers to either implicitly or explicitly refers to or relies on early Buddhist texts. But he doesn't actually give the quotes in detail. He kind of assumes that you know what he's talking about, right? He assumes that you're already familiar with these early Buddhist texts, and then he goes on to discuss about them. Now, it seems that when they took the text into Tibet, because they didn't have translations of all of the agamas, so the monks were reading this Abhidharma Kosha, and they didn't know what Vasubandhu was talking about. So a monk called Shamatadeva, around, I think, 700, between 7th and 8th century, around then, collected all of the sutta references which Vasubandhu gives and actually gives the full passages. Okay? And so that's what this book, Abhidharma Kosha Upayika Namatika, is. More briefly, we call it the Upayika. So it has, I think, a couple of hundred either full suttas or substantial quotes from suttas, and he even gives like the details, you know, this is the 32nd sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and goes on and then quotes the whole sutta. And so that's a very valuable resource which we have in Tibetan, and is now just being undertaken to be translated in English by Samaneri Dhammadina, who is an excellent Buddhist scholar. Her lay name is Juliana Martini, and she's just taken Samaneri ordination a year or two ago. And so she's doing this, I think, as a PhD project or something. So this is just one passage. I just sort of copied one passage out of her translation. It's just a part of one of the suttas in there. Then when a monk turns away from form, from rupa, is free from desire from it, proceeds towards cessation, he has no clinging and abides, having attained complete liberation of the mind from defilements or influxes, asavas, such a monk can be defined as a monk who has attained nirvana here and now. A monk who turns away from form, feeling, perception, consciousness. Form, feeling, perception, looks like it. Is that a mistake? Kara is missing and forms there twice. So I'm not sure if that's a mistake in the translation or if that's in the text itself. Anyway, I'll check that out. He has no clinging and abides, having attained complete liberation of the mind from defilement. Such a monk is a monk who's attained nirvana here and now. So that's just a random passage, but that just shows you that, that we're talking about exactly the same kinds of teachings that we find right throughout the Pali texts, especially this one from a Sanyutta Nikaya text. Okay, so that's enough for now. We should have a break and have a cup of tea. And after that, we'll come back for the discussion group, the first discussion. Oh, I completely forgot to do the meditation breaks. Oh, that's so terrible. No, we just have to stop now and go back and do the whole thing again and the meditation break again. I got so excited, I forgot all about it. That's very bad. Okay, next time we'll do the meditation breaks.